This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Now that the last of the Malia marauders have been taken into custody, it's a good time to examine the bigger picture. The standoff at the Malia National Wildlife Refuge is really just the extremist edge of a growing anti-conservation crusade bent on dismantling crucial environmental protections and abolishing most federal land. The crusade involves more menacing figures than the disgruntled ranchers who terrorized Harney County. This morning, we talk with environmental writer Jimmy Tobias about the crusaders in suits, the senators, the oil lobbyists, the right-wing legislators, who are the real threat to America's public lands. Jimmy wrote a recent article in the Pacific Standard called Beyond the Bundys, the Far Right and the Future of Conservation. His work has appeared in The Nation, Outside, High Country News, and other publications. Jimmy, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, things have changed a little bit on the landscape out in Harney County since you wrote the article. The last of the holdouts have surrendered to the federal authorities. And more importantly, in a way, Clavin Bundy, kind of the brain behind all of this, was busted at the Portland airport for his standoff with the FBI and federal agents a year and a half ago over the 20 years of grazing fees he refuses to pay. So I'm wondering if you're feeling that there's any more hope that there's some protections there for federal lands than we started to fear there weren't during the 41 or 42-day standoff.
Well, I think, you know, from my perspective, it was pretty clear that this standoff was eventually going to end. It is pretty amazing that it took 41 days to get them out of there. But I think, you know, obviously I don't want to downplay the trauma that Burns or Harney County has been through. I'm sure people are breathing a huge sigh of relief now that the Bundys are out of there. But, I mean, I think the larger threat to public lands is still very much alive and well, and the Bundys are just one small piece of that bigger puzzle.
Well, actually, I found it was very interesting to read some of the responses from Oregon's congressional delegation and our governor and people who were really upset about, for one thing, how long it took the feds to respond to that occupation. But I thought what Peter DeFazio, who's one of the congressmen here in Oregon, said very strongly, and I thought this is something that really should be taken stock of, is that if the feds had acted strongly against Clavin Bundy in 2014, when he and his friends held off the FBI and federal agents with guns for I don't know how many days, if they had moved in then, the occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge wouldn't have happened, and perhaps there would be a stronger understanding that federal lands need protection. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard to the Nevada standoff obviously was a very perilous situation for the BLM. And reading the complaint against Clavin Bundy, you can see how those BLM agents, their lives were in danger, and they really couldn't. I mean, there was nothing they could have done. I think they made the right call probably, but you know, I think regardless of how the Bundys in particular are handled, they are really good at catching media headlines. They're good at rallying militia members and sort of armed groups around these causes. But I think really they're sort of pawns in a much bigger and really more insidious effort in state legislatures, in the Congress, and, you know, efforts that are backed by oil interests and others, including the Koch network, that I think are much more, really are a much greater danger. And in some ways, I think that the Bundy standoff, especially this, especially the standoff at the National Wildlife Refuge, might actually help focus people's attention on these greater threats, these legislative attempts and lobbying efforts that are bent on dismantling the federal public lands and really eroding the most important conservation laws that we have.
Let's take that step back now and look at the bigger picture, and let's follow the tentacles. Let's see, it seems you mentioned them. These tentacles seem to all go back to the Koch brothers and their ilk. So let's talk about where the strategies, the theory, and the money's coming from that is funding this whole movement to basically dismantle federal lands.
Yeah, you know, just a few days ago, Ken Ivory, who's a right-wing state legislator in Utah, he had founded, back in 2012, a group called the American Lands Council, which was sort of a local effort to force the Utah state government to push the federal government to hand over public lands within Utah's boundaries. And he got a law passed in the legislature in 2012. It was called the Utah Transfer of Public Lands Act, and basically it called on the federal government to do just that, to hand over the federal lands, and if they didn't, it threatened a lawsuit. And now the state government in Utah is basically preparing the ground for a federal lawsuit against the government to try to requisition those lands. But just a few days ago, Ken Ivory announced he was leaving the American Lands Council to begin a new project called Free the Lands Project, and it's going to be led by a group called Federalism in Action, which was founded by the State Policy Network, which in turn is a well-known Koch brother entity. It's one of the big, it's a big player in the Koch network. It's a network of state lobbying organizations, basically, and policy groups that promote far-right libertarian causes. And so this group's new project, Federalism in Action, has launched its own land transfer effort, which it hopes to bring national. I mean, it hopes to what it wants to do is repeat its success in Utah in states around the country, and is very closely linked with the Koch brothers. And this is just a couple days ago, you know, the Bundy occupation happened, and then, you know, a few days, on February 11th, basically, Federalism in Action announced it would lead this new land transfer effort.
Well, a lot of my listeners are familiar with the Koch brothers. We've talked about them a lot on the show, mostly in connection with the fossil fuel industry and their fight against climate change, and also basically their general effort to create a right-wing sweep across politics in the United States. Why are the Koch brothers and their network so interested in the issue around federal lands?
Well, I mean, Ken Ivory during the Bundy occupation, Ken Ivory told some journalists in Nevada, I believe, that there's at least $1 trillion of mineral wealth on the federal lands. Oh, I'm sorry, $150 trillion in minerals locked up in western states on federal lands. So that's a huge amount of precious metals, of oil and gas, of coal. And, I mean, it seems pretty clear that if the federal lands were handed over to the states or privatized, which would likely happen in some cases, there would be basically just a free-for-all. People would have much easier access to the mineral wealth under these lands. Because, you know, if you think about it, it's much harder to buy a Congress and get them to, you know, and manipulate Congress, for instance. But it's much easier to buy a state legislature and sort of have them do their bidding. So if the federal lands were handed over to the state governments, I think it'd be much easier for very powerful economic interests to get their way and get access to these minerals that are currently off limits to them or have some sort of regulations that the feds enforce.
Well, according to what the Bundy brothers said in the beginning of the occupation of Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, it was about protecting the rights of ranchers to have the right to graze their cattle wherever they wanted to. But it was all about, I mean, it started out as all about ranchers' rights and all about grazing. This seems like a very different reality that you're describing. And I'm wondering, is there any connection between the whole movement of ranchers who want to have more access or want to have the same kind of access to BLM lands that they used to have before there were more controls, environmental controls? Or is this is that just a subterfuge for a much bigger agenda of being able to exploit public lands for all their mineral rights? Or mineral resources?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, someone like Ammon Bundy, he plays the part of a rancher very well, but, you know, he owns I believe it's a trucking business, and he lives in a big fancy house from what High Country News has reported. And I think, I think ranchers are a very convenient symbol for this fight. I think it kind of harkens back to the Sagebrush Rebellion. Ranchers and the federal government have been struggling over land rights issues for almost 100 years. And so it's a very convenient symbol for this kind of struggle. But I think it's more of a marketing tactic or a PR tactic than it is the truth, because there's a lot bigger interest in play here. And just the fact that the Koch Network is involved is pretty clearly a sign that this is about much more than individual ranchers. This is about a whole political ideology and an effort to basically dismantle American conservation as we know it. And, I mean, there's a lot of money at stake, a huge amount of money at stake. And I think in my article I said that what they're hoping to do is basically enact a huge redistribution of wealth away from the American people as a whole and into the hands of state legislatures or private interests, and they might succeed unless people really become aware of what's at stake here.
Well, I want to get more into the history of like the Sagebrush Rebellion and how the interests of ranchers and that whole movement, which has gained a fair amount of traction and I guess was epitomized by the Clive and Bundy standoff 2 years ago. How does that connect with this much bigger issue of actually dismantling our public land system, not so much so that ranchers, like there was somebody out in Eastern Oregon about 25 years ago who said, well, everybody in the United States, we should take all the public land and divide it up, everybody can get 10 acres. And, you know, but so that's like some of the thinking, I think, of some of the early Sagebrush Rebellion people. But how is that lead into a much bigger agenda, and how has the Sagebrush Rebellion and disgruntled ranchers kind of fed and enabled the Koch brothers and their allies to put their agenda across maybe in a way that has a more palatable face than if it was just the fossil fuel industries coming in and raping the land?
Yeah, I mean, High Country News had an interesting article about this the other day. I think it was titled "These Ain't Your Daddy's Sagebrush Rebels," because whereas the Sagebrush Rebellion was a more localized effort in many ways, and it was about sort of pragmatic concerns about access to grazing rights and things like that. I mean, obviously there was a lot of political rhetoric, and it became very extreme in some cases. But this is a much larger effort, basically. I mean, they definitely are connected, and you can kind of see it. You can kind of see it with the militia movement. I mean, you know, a lot of the Oath Keepers, the Pacific Patriots Network, the 3%. These are militia movements that sort of are focused on gun rights, for instance. But they see in the land transfer movement sort of a deeply anti-federal political ideology, and so they find common cause. And so this is sort of, I think this is a big, the High Country News called it a Sagebrush insurgency instead of the Sagebrush rebellion, kind of to indicate that it's a broader networked effort that kind of ties together many different threads, including, you know, the Sagebrush rebels, people, ranchers concerned about their land, but it brings together many other groups, including militias and, you know, oil lobbyists. And so I think it's a much bigger, it's just a more networked and broader effort, it seems, that also includes some of the folks and ideologies that characterize the Sagebrush Rebellion.
Well, if the Koch brothers had their way, and this fellow from Utah, who's now working with the Koch brothers more closely, And there was a lot more resource extraction on federal lands, and there were like fracking everywhere, and there was mining everywhere. How would this benefit the ranchers who are clamoring to have more access to federal lands and be less inhibited by environmental laws in order for them to do basically to run their cattle? I mean, how would it impact these guys' ability to continue to ranch?
Yeah, well, you know, you look at someone like Cliven Bundy who hasn't paid his grazing fees in decades, and who basically believes that the land is his and not the American people's, and so he wants basically unfettered access without any kind of any kind of control, any kind of regulation. He wants ownership of the land that belongs to everyone, and so I mean, obviously there would be clear benefits there. I think people like the Bundys sort of harken back to the open range. You know, and have a very romantic view of what that was. And so, you know, there could be benefits in those, in that sense. And really this movement, you know, is more than just about privatizing the land. There's also been a concerted effort to undermine the Endangered Species Act, for instance, which, you know, limits economic activity in certain cases to protect wildlife. I mean, last year alone there were, I believe, more than 80 attempts to water down or undermine the act in Congress. And many of the people who are pushing bills to water down the Endangered Species Act are also the people in Congress, like Representative Rob Bishop, Mark Amoday, who are also promoting the transfer of public lands to states. And so, you know, this is sort of a comprehensive effort to chip away at conservation legislation, conservation laws like the Endangered Species Act, and also really the bedrock of American conservation in general, which are the public lands. And so you can see how that might benefit economically someone like Cliven Bundy, who doesn't want to have to answer to anyone about what he does on the range in Nevada.
So you think he'd be just as happy to be fracking or mining than ranching? And he's basically not that attached to ranching. He's just attached to having access to lands to exploit.
Well, I'm not. You know, it's hard to say. I think he's. It seems like he's a legitimate rancher, but you know, the same kind of laws and regulations that limit, you know, how many cattle you can put on the range. You know, there are also laws and regulations that apply to oil and gas drilling. So I think, what in general, if environmental regulations were watered down or gotten rid of, you know, someone like Cliven Bundy would probably benefit, as would, you know, the local fracking company or larger oil interests. So basically it's about opening up resource extraction in general on the public lands by turning them private, or at least handing them to the states where legislatures and regulators are much more easily controlled.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the aftermath, for one thing, of the Bundy brothers' occupation of Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and who the people are that we really should be watching, the suits who are really in control or directing a movement to dismantle our public lands. My guest is Jimmy Tobias, who wrote an article in the Pacific Standard called Beyond the Bundys, the Far Right, and the Future of Conservation. I still have this question, though, for Cliven Bundy. I've been reading a lot about the impacts of fracking on ranching up in Alberta, and the same thing is probably true in North Dakota and other areas that were traditionally ranching areas that are now becoming fracking centers. And that the impact of fracking on large-scale ranching is pretty detrimental. And I wonder if Cliven Bundy has considered that he might lose his cattle to all kinds of contaminants in the water and other issues if he were to be part of a movement to just dismantle all environmental regulations on public land.
Well, I think, you know, yeah, I think it's sort of ironic. A lot of the people, you know, who promote this sort of land transfer effort aren't necessarily, I think, tuned into the broader interests at play here. And I think there's sort of, Hal Herring had an interesting essay the other day. He's a great writer from Montana. You know, I think he sort of saw some of these folks as being played by a bigger interest, and not really realizing that they probably stand to lose too, because the public lands benefit people who don't have, you know, the money to buy their own parcel of land, or who don't have the ability to go on, you know, a fancy vacation. I mean, they're a cheap way to recreate, to put your cows out on the range. It's really a populist economic institution, the public lands are, and so people who are fighting against them, unless they're wealthy industrialists, I think they stand to lose a lot if these lands get handed over to the states. And so it's it's sort of ironic to see, but I also think the Bundys have other interests at play. They're deeply religious Mormons, and I think they have some other sort of ideologies driving their efforts here as well.
It does seem to be one of my favorite moments about the surrender of the last four holdouts at Mellyer was the last guy to go, David Frye. He wouldn't leave until the FBI agent said hallelujah. And
right.
The FBI agent smartly said hallelujah, and David left. And I thought that it says something. I mean, I can't quite absorb just exactly what it says, but to me it really spoke volumes about the mindset and how this was coming from a worldview that I think very few people who live in cities outside of Mormon centers understands. I mean, how did that resonate with you, and how do you think that resonates with people who've been following the story?
Can you repeat that again? Can you repeat that question?
Well, I just wondered what your response to hearing that David Frye would not leave the refuge until the FBI agent said hallelujah. The FBI agent said it pretty easily. It doesn't mean the same to the FBI agent that it meant to David Frye, but somehow it meant volumes to David Frye.
Yeah, you know, I don't know exactly how to read that, but I think there's obviously a lot of deeply religious beliefs, especially among Mormons, about their claim to the lands. The state of Deseret is sort of a utopian Mormon ideal. You know, they want to create a state, and that's been a sort of a lingering ideal for many years within the Mormon Church.
I mean, Utah's not enough?
What'd you say? Yeah, I think not. And so, you know, I'm not as well versed in that sort of that portion of this, but I think that definitely plays a role, especially with the Bundys and their supporters. You know, but like I said, that's just one small piece of this broader puzzle. So,
well, you mentioned in your article about numbers of public officials who would start by saying, "We do not support the tactics of armed insurrection or, you know, armed takeover of the refuge." However, their issues are valid. And
right.
I wonder if we could talk about some of the public officials who've made that statement and what that really means.
Yeah, I mean, you hear that a lot. It's basically, oh, we don't support their tactics, but we support their grievances, or we understand their grievances. And, I mean, you got that a lot. You had Rob Bishop in Congress. He had a statement along those lines. You had Kathleen Scammon at the Western Energy Alliance, who had a similar perspective. Jennifer Fielder, a state senator from Montana, had a very similar public statement, and she now took over the American Lands Council. You know, Ken Ivory, who is the founder of the American Lands Council and a big player in the land transfer movement, he had similar thoughts. So, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the groups who are pushing land transfer, you know, they're saying they don't support this kind of tactic, but they're basically, you know, kind of winking on the side and saying, but we get it, you know, we get what you're doing, we get what you're, we get why you're so angry. And I think, you know, this probably provides a lot of fuel for their movement in some respects. I think it could go either way, but I think, you know, this sort of tactic by the Bundys puts a lot of attention on what they're trying to accomplish and gets a lot of people on the far right very interested in promoting and supporting land transfer and this anti-conservation effort.
Well, actually, what I found the most chilling was Greg Walden, who is the U.S. congressman who represents Harney County. And he was kind of saying, well, we should listen more closely to their concerns, and these concerns are valid. And I don't know how much pressure he's feeling from, it is a conservative, his district is partially very conservative and partially not conservative at all, but it seems that this seemed to me the furthest right I've ever heard Greg Walden go as far as public lands. It wasn't that long ago, just a few years ago, he and Earl Blumenauer were hiking around Mount Hood, as Earl was pointing out to him all the areas that should be included in the increased wilderness area, which was then voted on, and Greg Walden was a supporter of that. So that concerns me, and I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, well, you know, in Congress, there's definitely, obviously, we've seen right-wing Republicans and Congress people gain a lot more power in recent years. The Freedom Caucus, which is basically a, you know, a Tea Party far-right group, has become ever more prominent and helped push out John Boehner. And now a bunch of Congress people have formed a federal land action group, which is pretty much solely focused on transferring legislation. And so these people in Congress are gaining a lot of ground and a lot of power, and their voice is growing. And so, I mean, you know, it's not surprising to see someone like Greg Walden, who's from a very rural district in Oregon, support this. I mean, not necessarily support this. Obviously, I don't think he was supporting the actions by the Bundys at all, but sympathize. There's just a lot of sympathy for what's happening here because, you know, the Koch Network and people like Ken Ivory have been, you know, pounding the pavement for years promoting this message that the feds are, you know, unresponsive, faceless bureaucrats, that they're out to take your land and limit your freedom. I mean, this has been a key part of the far-right rhetoric in our country for years, and it's really bearing fruit. And in the last few years, you can just really see how it's bearing fruit and how people are latching onto it to kind of, in the age of Obama, kind of connect different movements from gun rights people to, you know, land transfer to people who, to the oil industry's longtime opposition to things like the Endangered Species Act. You can see how this is kind of a great way to connect all the dots. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously it's disappointing that Greg Walden said some of the things he did, but I think it's not entirely surprising given the political political climate in Congress.
But interestingly, in Harney County itself, there was very, very little support for either the takeover or the views that were being expressed, because the county is highly dependent on the federal government for revenue, the BLM and the Fish and Wildlife Service and the USDA play a major stake in the economy of Harney County, and the Malheur Wildlife Refuge is at the center of that. And there's a long time work of building coalitions between and cooperation between the ranchers and the wildlife refuge and the feds. Right. So it seemed to me that most of the people in Harney County were not just vehemently opposed to the occupation, but were like doing everything possible to restate their position. And I just wonder if maybe they picked the wrong place for this stand, that if maybe they had stayed in Nevada or Utah, they might have gotten more buy-in from the local population. And the fact that they didn't get that buy-in from either the people or from the sheriff or from the equivalent of the county commission is perhaps detrimental in some ways to their efforts to spread the movement, and that in fact it's created a counterforce that might actually propel stronger support for public lands.
I mean, I definitely think that is a possibility, and that I'm hoping that will be the outcome here, because yeah, it seems like it was, I it's hard to know what they were thinking when they took over the refuge, but it seems like it was sort of spur of the moment. It seems like it wasn't
spur of the moment. They've been planning that since last October or November, actually. So
It just didn't seem so well planned out, like you said, like you mentioned, like if they'd gone to a place where a sheriff had, a sheriff had been more sympathetic, it might have been a much different situation. And so maybe they just didn't really know. Maybe they didn't know enough about the place. But I think it's very possible that this incident will sort of rally the public lands forces around protecting. I think it has brought a lot of attention on the very serious threats that the public lands face right now from Congress and from groups like, you know, militia groups and people like the Bundys. And I think that could potentially be a silver lining here and really rally the conservation community around public lands, because conservation in this country really began in many ways with the establishment and protection of the public lands. And so without them, I think that the environmental movement in general and conservation in particular would be really, you know, would face a huge setback, really a crippling setback. And so I think because they failed to rally the troops, because the Bundys failed to really hold the refuge for any very extended period of time, because they failed to really rally people to their cause there, I think it could kind of it could promote just the opposite of what they wanted.
Well, I think, in fact, it did in many ways. In fact, what was really rallied around the state of Oregon was immense outpouring of support for the refuge, for the whole concept of public lands, for, of course, the outrage at armed thugs taking over the refuge. And there were demonstrations and rallies across the state in cities and in rural areas around the state. And then finally, the last outpouring was in Harney County just shortly before the last holdouts were taken and surrendered. So I thought that when I saw that this uprising, it's been a long time, if ever, that I've seen demonstrations in support of public land. So I wonder if this is a new direction that we're going in, and in fact, that the really ugly image of these thugs with guns taking over public land might do something to actually create a black eye for the suits that are kind of hiding behind the thugs and who have much bigger designs.
Yeah, I think it definitely could, and I think that would be, you know, I think that would take organizing and a lot of planning on the part of the conservation community to really focus people's anger over what happened in Oregon and kind of funnel it towards the people who are really threatening public lands, people in Congress, the people in the state legislatures, people like Ken Ivory. I think that is a very important step forward if the conservation community takes it in that direction. But there in general, there does seem to be an increased focus from the environmental movement on public lands. There's this keep it in the ground effort that is sort of gaining steam across the West, that's trying to actually prevent the federal government from giving more leases, more oil and gas leases, more coal deals on the federal lands in light of climate change. And so it's sort of interesting to see this sort of counterpoint to the transfer of land movement. And I don't think it's a coincidence, because you have the environmental community, the climate movement, gaining a lot of ground in this country, and they see the public lands and limiting fossil fuel extraction on the public lands as a major priority. And you see people like the Koch brothers who are increasingly hostile to the public lands because they see their business model threatened, by a resurgent climate movement. And so, all of these things are connected, from the Bundys to the climate movement to the Koch brothers, and it's really about who's going to be able to determine the future of energy policy in this country, and who's going to be able to kind of, this struggle between fossil fuel interests and the climate movement and the conservation movement, kind of where will it end up? And so I think this is just one small sort of saga in a much greater story.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jimmy Tobias, who wrote a recent article in the Pacific Standard called Beyond the Bundys, the Far Right and the Future of Conservation. So what should people be looking out for as far as efforts, legislative efforts and other efforts to dismantle our public lands? And let's kind of recap what happened in Utah and how you're concerned that that might be a model for the rest of the country.
Yeah, well, in Utah, a right-wing legislator named Ken Ivory started a group called American Lands Council, which had the goal of pushing Utah to pressure the federal government to hand over land. And he got a law passed with the help of his fellow legislators called the Utah Transfer of Public Lands Act. And now Utah is, under the auspices of that law, is preparing the ground for a major lawsuit against the federal government to try to requisition the federal lands within its boundaries. And since that time, Ivory has teamed up with the American Legislative Exchange Council and gone around the country trying to get similar bills in many western states. And so you've seen bills or studies focused on this issue get introduced in numerous western states: Arizona, New Mexico, Montana, and others. Ken Ivory is taking that effort national with a group called Federalism in Action, which is linked to the Koch State Policy Network. And so so he's basically trying to expand on his success in Utah. And I think, I think what people can do is identify the legislators in their communities who are pushing this, effort, because it's usually not very many people. It's usually a small, hardcore group of right-wing Republicans who are trying to change the debate about public lands But I think we will see with this Federalism in Action effort by Ken Ivory, I think we will see a more sophisticated use of the Koch network, of this state policy network, which the state policy network basically is a network of far-right lobbying groups, and there's numerous groups in every state, and they have a presence pretty much everywhere, and they're closely aligned with Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch's grassroots group. And I think what we're going to see is sort of a collective effort by these Koch network groups to start pushing these policies hard in different states, and to build state support for national land transfer legislation. And so I think people really need to delineate the different groups and identify the different groups and players so that they can be countered, basically. And that's, I think that's important work for the conservation movement moving forward, and for journalists as well.
Definitely for journalists. I think we should put a lot of pressure on our journalists to do this, and we're glad that you're doing the work that you're doing. Well, sort of looking ahead a little bit and doing a little bit of prognosticating, what do you think about the impact of Justice Scalia's death this weekend and the fight over who gets to appoint the next Supreme Court justice? What impact might that have on some court decisions, which would have a great deal of impact on the future of public lands?
I mean, I think that will be very important. I think one of the big avenues of the land transfer movement is going to be the courts in the future. You know, I mentioned that Utah is preparing a lawsuit. Ken Ivory and his people think that they have a constitutional argument to make about why the states should have access to the federal public lands and should own the federal public lands. And I think they were, at least from the legal perspective, I think they were definitely counting on a conservative majority in the Supreme Court. Without it, they stand absolutely no chance to succeed in the courts. And so and so I think that I'm sure they are very disappointed, and I'm sure they're all supporting the Republicans' efforts to stonewall Obama until he's out of office. Because without a conservative majority, they won't be able to succeed in the courts. So they'll have to turn to Congress, where it's a pretty long shot. I mean, especially if a Democratic president is elected, no land transfer will not happen as long as a Democrat's in the White House, and as long as the Supreme Court, you know, is split evenly or has a liberal majority. And so this could really set back their efforts, I think. And I think it would actually probably end this attempt if this election doesn't go their way, this coming election doesn't go their way.
Well, there's so many different issues on the plate for progressives right now. And I think for a lot of people, it's kind of the priority. It starts with climate change, and then it's all the other things that kind of filter out of climate change. And then, of course, there's economic justice, and there's concerns and water concerns. And, of course, the pollution of the water in Flint, Michigan raises a whole lot of other sets of issues. So I wonder how public lands and the concerns about protecting public lands fit into this hierarchy of agendas, and how we can get people to see that it's very strongly connected, probably not just to preventing the worst parts, the worst possibilities of climate change, but also it's a big part of environmental and economic justice, and it's a big part of all of our lives.
Right, and it's a huge economic driver too. You know, there's a lot of jobs. The outdoor economy is a huge economy. It provides a lot of jobs for a lot of people, and that's also important to remember. But I think, you know, in terms of climate, there's no question that the public lands are very crucial. If the public lands are opened up increasingly to drilling and coal mining, then I think that the climate movement will have lost. So it's a crucial battleground for the climate movement, no question about it. And I think, you know, it really is about, our democratic republic. The public lands are a wonderful experiment in democratic ownership, and they provide a lot of things to a lot of people, from open space to jobs to, from open space to jobs to recreation to a way to get outside for cheap or for free and be healthy. And
I mean, not only that, a lot of us, well, here in Oregon, our water comes from public lands.
Right. No question about it. Watershed protection. I mean, you know, healthy forests mean clean water in a lot of places in this country. And so I think there is, you know, a lot to be said for the importance of the public lands. And they're really one of the most important populist or public institutions in our country, like Social Security or the post office, or I mean, they're a crucial institution and a legacy of liberalism in the society. And I think that's why they are such a target, because they stand for a lot and they mean a lot to a lot of people. And without them, I think the power dynamics in the West and elsewhere around the country would really shift in favor of the wealthy. And ultimately, that seems to be what the Koch network and people like them are trying to achieve, some sort of oligarchy, more or less, as certain presidential candidates have been talking about.
Well, one of the concerns that I have, there's been discussions in Harney County since the end of the occupation about addressing some of the issues and concerns that people in the community have about their relationship to the public lands and how they're managed. And I don't know if that's a subtext for saying, well, maybe we should have a land transfer. So I'm wondering how you see, what kind of dialogue can we have where we address, are there valid concerns that ranchers have? And is there a way to address them that does not rely, you know, does not just go back to transferring the lands to state or county ownership?
I think they're definitely, I think some concerns are definitely valid. You hear stories about federal agencies that don't, some of these stories are obviously part of this, you know, the rhetoric coming from the far right, but I think there's also legitimacy in people's complaints sometimes that the federal agencies do always do a good job listening to the local community. And I think something that's gaining a lot of ground in the conservation world right now is collaborative conservation, working with different interest groups in a community to decide how to move forward on wildlife conservation, water conservation, rangeland conservation. And I think that's a very important step in the right direction for alleviating some of the concerns that people have felt over the years. And a lot of this has to do with the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act, if it goes into effect, can be very can really clamp down on people's economic opportunities and possibilities. And so I think what people are increasingly realizing is we need to prevent endangered species listings by working on these problems before they get so bad that something like the Endangered Species Act has to come into play.
Well, actually, I'm thinking about the last time we talked was about the sage grass.
Right.
And that's in Harney County, they prevented the listing by doing this collaboration. And I guess some people were not happy about it, but it seemed to be that might have been one of the reasons why there was so little buy-in on the part of the community for the Bundy brothers' takeover.
Yeah, I mean, the sage grouse is a really interesting example. It's definitely the most, I'd say the biggest recent experiment in collaborative conservation. It's also going to test whether that collaborative conservation can really work on that landscape, because in that case, again, like we talked about last time, there's a lot of interest groups, including oil and gas, that really don't want any kind of limitation on their activity and are even trying to chip away at the collaborative conservation agreements that were made around sage grouse. But I think overall that philosophy is very valid and important if people want to avoid things like the Endangered Species Act becoming part of their, you know, economic considerations. And so there are things to be done that can alleviate some of the tensions, I think, between local communities and federal agencies. And I think that people are becoming increasingly aware of it. And I think federal agencies should be pushed to do their very best to communicate with local communities and to work with local communities. And I think a lot of people are in these agencies are open to that and want to do that too, because they are part of it. Like the Harney County situation showed us, I mean, the federal agencies, the people who work for them are also part of the community. They also live in these communities and these towns, and their kids go to these schools. And so it's not like they're faceless bureaucrats like the Bundys want to portray them, but they're real people who are part of these communities. And so I think that provides a lot. I think that's very hopeful.
Well, Jimmy, it's great talking with you again. Keep me posted.
You as well.
Keep me posted on your next article. I'm sure it'll be relevant to the show.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot. We've been talking this morning with Jimmy Tobias, who wrote the recent article, Beyond the Bundys, the Far Right, and the Future of Conservation. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll be talking with forest ecologist Dominic Della Sala and Chad Hansen about the ecological importance of mixed severity wildfires. My engineer is Kathleen Stevenson. We're going to go out with some music by Ricky Lee Jones. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
Known to the wicked and the wise. on February 20th from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m. Grassroots News will honor the memory, legacy, and life of Malcolm X. Join us for the music, the memory, and the deconstruction of Malcolm's political career, his split from the Nation of Islam, and the course of actions that led to his assassination 51 years ago on February 21st, 1965. As Ozzie Davis eulogized,
"A prince, our own black shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so."
Again, on February 20th, from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m., join us as we honor the memory, life, and legacy of Malcolm X.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11:30, we speak with reporter Dan Forbes about his recent articles in the Portland Mercury on the art glass factories in Portland and associated or surrounding high levels of toxic chemicals. And coming up next, on the radio zine, Kristen Yant continues her coverage on the Portland Harbor Superfund site. She presents a report with highlights and interviews.